Hey, John.
Hey, Nick.
Can I read you a little verse from the Bible here that I have in my hand?
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, please. By all means.
In the beginning, God created the heaven, the earth, and video games. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1.
Oh, right. That was when you said I had an intro, that was it.
Yeah, and this is Stranger Still. Stranger Still,
a podcast where we fight to the battle of the death of the fight with our fists and our minds. I'm John Beacon.
I'm Nick Wood. Are we fighting?
I just felt like I needed a good aggressive energy for all this heat we're gonna feel today.
Yeah, I guess so. It is hot in here. My AC is not on, but
that's because you're a hippie. That's not because you studied hard.
That's true. You know, this is totally off topic, but today my daughter was asking me and my wife to fight because we never fight. We were effective communicators, in my opinion. But she was like, "You need to say something mean to mommy." And I was like, "What? Why?" And she's like, "So you guys can't fight." So I said something stupid like, "I love you," and Shelby didn't reciprocate. So Roy's like, "We gotta get her to say something mean back." I was like, "What is wrong with you?"
Jesus, what are they doing on Paw Patrol?
I don't know.
Doc McStuffins is like really cute and sweet, and as soon as the moms fall away, they get to TV.
Yeah,
make your parents fight.
As soon as we look away, it's like that. What was that YouTube witch that went around? I don't know, whatever. You know what I'm talking about? Anyway.
YouTube Twitch?
It was like that urban legend about that, like that.
Oh yeah, it would be innocent kid shows, and then like halfway in, it would tell you to do horrible things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know what I'm talking about. I don't remember what that's called. It was really dumb. Anyway, this week we're talking about something very near and dear to our hearts. And it feels a little weird to talk about because we don't talk about our love for video games very much.
It's a long time overdue. Like, we could probably do a whole show on video games.
Yeah. Actually, this is going to cover a lot of history.
Everyone and their mom, so why?
Yeah. What are you playing right now? Some stupid game I've never heard of?
I'm casually, you could say, playing Battle Cats on my phone, but I'm also playing Call of Duty Modern Warfare nonstop.
Yeah. Me and my wife, Shelby, are just playing Animal Crossing, and it's...
On the same account? What, do you, like, pass it?
No, on the same, well, on the same
you
island.
Do it short?
Oh, okay. She's got her own account.
How many Switches do you have?
Just one, but
so you pass the Switch?
No.
And then I just swept my Animal Crossing room. Now you go pay the raccoon. Oh, did you forget to pay the bills? Like, it just, there's your fight. Oh, I forgot to pay off Tom Nook.
Shelby did get mad at me for digging up her flowers once. That was, like, the biggest fight we've ever got into. And it wasn't that big. So, for those who haven't turned away yet, I do want to make the distinction that it would sound like this episode is going to be for video game fans or gamers, as the kids say these days. But
the kids say these days, you bat and a half? Are you kidding me? What are you watching?
I was watching those. It's that? Doc McStuffins. That's what she calls him. She calls him elite epic gamers.
As the us say these days, because she's a kid.
Yeah. So I just want to point out that this isn't for just people who play video games. This is
not your dad's podcast episode, is what Nick's trying to say.
Within this episode, within the confines of this episode, is a tale of how the butterfly effect took a simple industry that was like basically hoisted on the back of like three people to now we have all these people that hate you if you don't have the same console as them. There's these bitter rivalries between companies and fan bases and fanboys that all happened because a few key things in the 80s and 90s that I think you'll find interesting.
Wow. It's like I'm listening to a TV show or something.
It's got to have like a little jingle afterward. But You've heard of video games. How far back do you think the history of video games goes, John?
Well, Nicholas, video is a Latin term that derives from the word Vidaya, which was the god of imagery in ancient papyrus Egypt. And what happened is when Vidaeus casted upon the citizens of Papyrus, she said, "Hey, let's play a game. I'm bored." And they were like, "LOL, what? We don't have any games. This is Egypt." And Papyrus said, "I shall grant it upon thee." And then they were like, "Okay, if you say jump, I'll jump." And then they would control Papyrus in the sky because they're a sky god.
Yeah, that's where Ancient Aliens gets most of this content.
1985, I think. Actually, I'm going to erase everything I said. I'm going to say Atari. 1985?
Well, it goes back. I mean, you could probably go back to ancient Egypt or the city of Papyrus that you just made up.
Best font. Worst city.
It's not a city. It's a material.
You look at their signs. You look at their signs. You've never seen Papyrus font?
Never mind. I won't go down that rabbit hole. The problem is you started off so convincing with Vidaya, and I had to like second guess myself, and then you just veered a little bit off course there. You know what I mean? Well, for our story, I'm going to start in the 1920s to the 1940s. There was this thing you may have heard of called pinball. And pinball was incredibly popular. Eventually got outlawed because it was perceived as gambling. That's like a whole episode in and of itself. But this sparked other games like skee-ball and like what you'd call carnival games anymore. But they had arcades back then, back in the 20s and 40s, based around pinball and these other simple games that just worked off of wood pushing into each other. That came out wrong.
Wow. Is that about your marriage or is that video games? Continue before. Okay.
Well, in other parts of the world, and by other parts of the world, I mean other industries, these little things called computers started to emerge. You've heard of these, right?
Yeah. I've got a tiny one in my phone. Thanks.
Yeah. With these giant computers that were the size of rooms at the time, students started making games on them, and they would get circulated around to various schools. It was like an early form of going viral. They'd put it on like a little piece of paper, and you'd put it in your punch card. And in 1962, there was this...
It took five 40-foot rooms to buy one ox in the Oregon Trail back then.
They actually did have Oregon Trail really early on. I don't remember when the first one was, but it was on a text-based computer. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. We should do a whole episode on the Oregon Trail. Just the video game, though, not like the actual Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
But the video games really took off in the 60s and 70s. In 1962, this game called Space War with an exclamation point was created by students at MIT, and it got circulated around just like all the other games. But what was important was it eventually caught the attention and admiration of a man named Nolan Bushnell. You might know him as the founder of Chuck E. Cheese Pizza.
Hmm?
Nolan Bushnell?
Nolan Bushnell. Invented Chuck E. Cheese Pizza?
Yeah. But more importantly for our story, you look unconvinced.
I don't think he did, Nicholas. Did you hear how high I registered my voice was there? That's a convincing "I don't think he did." Well, I don't think he did.
I don't know how else to convince you, but he did. For our story, what's more important is in 1971, him and a man named Ted Dabney created a game called Computer Space. I had to double check it because I was like, that's a dumb name for a game, but it was called Computer Space. And it wasn't very successful. They put it in a bar and nobody really wanted to buy it. But a year later, they found a couple other engineers. They saw this game called Ping Pong that was being circulated by Magnavox at the time. And they said, "Hey, we could do this and we could do it better." And they made their game that I won't say yet. They put it in a bar. And the first night they put it in a bar to test it out to see if people liked it, it broke down, which sounds bad, but it broke down because it had too many quarters in it. Because people were itching to play it. That game was
a Pong.
It was Pong. I thought you were going to give me some dumb answer, but it was Pong. It took the world by storm, and eventually Nolan Bushnell, Ted Dabney, and their associates formed Atari, as you mentioned before. I mentioned Magnavox briefly. Earlier that year, they had tried their hands at the very first home console. It was the Magnavox Odyssey, nothing to do with Mario Odyssey. But it was this little console that you could only hook up to Magnavox TVs. And you had these little films that you would put on top of your screen, and like the static electricity would stick them to the screen, and the light would shine through, and you'd play it on these little mats. That's how you'd play these games. It wasn't successful because that's a lot of work. But it gave Nolan Bushnell the idea for Pong.
Window Clings, the game!
That's basically what it is. Yeah. But home consoles didn't make a splash until Atari put out the home version of Pong in 1975. And apparently, they couldn't find a distributor for it, so they had to sell it themselves in the Sears catalog, the Sears and Roebuck catalog, which seems, I'm sure, all the companies they approached are kicking themselves now. But following the wild success of Pong, the success that Pong brought to Atari, they produced the Atari 2600 in 1977, just 2 years later. And what was notable about this was it came with different types of controllers for the games. You could have a joystick, or you could have the little paddle where you twisted it back and forth to move the Pong
knob.
The knob. But you could also change the game, so you could take out Brick Break and put in Pong, or you could take out Pong and put in Adventure or whatever. It sold for $200 in the United States, which is equivalent to about $850 in today's money, which if you tried to sell a console for that now, people would think you're out of your mind. People thought it was crazy when the PlayStation 3 sold for $600. But despite the price, they sold 30 million of them around the world. And as we go through this episode, when I talk about units sold, this is worldwide. It's not any particular
country. Were these home units, or was it people that were buying them for bars and stuff like that?
I think they sold like 4,000 bar units, if I remember correctly. But these are in-home units. These are the Atari 2600s.
Damn.
Yeah. But after that, people were gobbling it up, and everyone and their mother was trying their hand at home consoles. So some of the notable home consoles that people were trying out were the Magnavox Odyssey 2 in 1978. They just had to give it another shot. We have one of them in my parents' basement, and I can't remember which one it is. I'm going to have to dig that out and figure out which one it is. They made a couple of them. Mattel, famous for Barbies, put out the Intellivision in 1980. Coleco put out the ColecoVision in 1981. I've heard of all these, but I don't even know what kind of games they had. But even Atari was like, nah, the 2600 isn't good enough. Let's double it. And they put out the Atari 5200 in 1982. Did you ever have any of these at your homestead?
No. I mean, what am I, a year or two older than you? I was
Yeah, but your dad's a pretty savvy guy. I didn't know if he'd be like, oh, I gotta have the ColecoVision.
He probably had stuff like that. He had like really vintage good videography equipment for filming weddings. He had a toaster which had like effects built in that he'd hit live to edit weddings. But as far as tech goes, I mean, the first like thing that we actually bought as a family was Sega Genesis.
Gotcha. Okay. So. Well, something drastic happened around 1982 and 1983. There was the great video game crash. And if I could make my voice echo, I would, but my effects are way over there and I don't want to do it. But there was a lot of companies were competing with each other, obviously. Like I named three, but if you go to the Wikipedia page for first generation consoles, I think there's 177 of them listed. That's saturation if I've ever heard of it. Everyone was trying to get the hot new game on the market. They wanted their Pong, they wanted their Arkanoid, they wanted that cashola. But unfortunately, that meant a lot of these companies were just rushing to get their games out, and they had little to no concern for quality, and people became fatigued. Couple that with there's a bunch of like PTA organizations that thought video games were ruining society, and the video game market was on the verge of collapse. And a lot of people point to the colossal failure of the ET game on the Atari as a prime example of this. Have you heard of this?
Well, not only have I heard of it, Nicholas, I've listened to the Stuff You Should Know episode on it.
Oh, did they? They did an episode on it. That's interesting.
And it's beautiful. Like, they asked one dude to make that game in, like, a month.
Yeah.
And gave him, like, no time to do it. And for what it's worth, he did a pretty killer job.
So in preparation of Christmas in 1983, Atari was trying to cash in on the success of E.T., the movie. And they developed a, they were developing a game tie-in for it. And like you mentioned, they had one guy working on it. And that's how video games were for the most part. Back then you had like three people max working on them. But it was rushed to completion and it sucked horribly. Like it's almost unplayable. But what's interesting is now modders have fixed a lot of the mechanics and added stuff in. So you can find ROMs of ET like fixed, which I think is hilarious. But for a long time, there was this urban myth or this rumor that all of the unsold copies of ET had been dumped into a landfill in the desert in Nevada, or New Mexico. But it wasn't confirmed until 2014 when a team of documentarians were like, hey, can we dig this up and see if it's there? And sure enough, when the burial site was exhumed, they found thousands of copies of ET alongside other copies or other Atari games that just didn't sell. And this should go as no surprise. It did a lot of damage to Atari and video games as a whole. And luckily, a tiny company from Japan swooped in and saved us all on July 15th, 1983. Any ideas who that was? That's right, Sega. On July 15th, 1983, Sega released the Sega SG-1000. This was the first home console released by Sega, but surprisingly, I had never heard of it. Maybe that's because on the exact same day, a little company called Nintendo released the Famicom in Japan. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners already know this, but Nintendo's actually been around since 1880. That's right, 18.
Company, right?
Yeah, they were a playing card company and a toy manufacturer. Like they had like this claw that extended out and grabbed stuff that they were really fond of. They started branching out. They had the little Game & Watch portable games on like the, I don't even know what you call them, those crappy screens. You know what I'm talking about?
Mr. Game & Watch is like the ink screens.
Yeah, they branched out a little bit further in 1981. They released Donkey Kong into the arcades. But in 1983, the Famicom came out, and in the U.S., you might know it as the Nintendo Entertainment System, or the NES, that came out in 1985, 2 years later. And what's interesting, this is where our butterfly effect starts to take effect. So take notes here. The United States was just coming off the video game crash, so Nintendo, being cognizant of that, was like, if we say that this plays video games, we're never going to sell any of them. So to distance themselves from the word video game at all, they called it the entertainment system. They also felt that it made it sound more sophisticated, which to me as a child was just confusing, but that's neither here nor there. And the reason that this was important is because they also saw this lack of quality control that everyone else had saw. And they went about making sure all of the games published on their system met strict quality control standards. Of course, there's still crappy games out there, like, what was the crappy one that I had in my mind? Was it Ghostbusters 2? It might have been. But if you look at any of your old games, they all have that Nintendo seal of approval, because they had to go through an approval process. There were a few like pirated games. I have one where this company was making Christian games and they couldn't get them approved through Nintendo. So they got these bootleg cartridges. They're like black and they have like a divot on the top of them. So those don't have the seal of approval, but every other game does. But what it meant for game developers is it was a lot harder to get their games published. So you could put all this work into this game and you might not even get it on the system because it didn't meet Nintendo standards. It also meant that it was a lot more family friendly, and that was to ensure all audiences would enjoy the game. But the NES sold in, at least in the United States, it sold in a bunch of different bundles, anywhere from $99.99 to $179.99, which is a range of $240 or $430 in today's money. Which I say all this, what's that?
The same amount
yes,
that people are paying now.
Exactly. That's why I bring up all these prices. I wanted to make sure that I got an inflation calculator on all these, because you hear a lot of talk of like, oh my God, video games are so expensive these days. And it's like, actually, they haven't changed much. It's just that our perception of money has changed, but that's neither here nor there. And it sold 60 million units worldwide, John.
That's a lot. That's a big number.
That is a big number. Big
numbers and how impressive they are?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big one right there.
Yeah, you want to hear a less big number?
Well, I was going to give you a bigger one real quick.
Go for it. You did this joke before.
200,000,372.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
100 million.
Yeah. Anyway, the Sega SG-1000 that came out on the same day apparently only sold 150,000 units.
Mm-hmm.
Wikipedia also says that it might have sold 2 million units, so who knows? Either way, Sega was not satisfied with their sales figures. So 2 years later, they released the infamous Sega Master System.
Yeah.
So I know about the Sega Master System. I have no idea what games were on it. It also didn't sell nearly as well as the NES at the time. Sold 13 million units at $200 each, so it was $475. And that's at the high end of the Nintendo bundle. Like the $180 bundle of Nintendo came with, like, I think it came with Mario Duck Hunt and the Blaster or something like that. But anyway, this brings us to 1989. The industry slept for a while.
That's the year I was born, Nicholas.
That is the year you were born. This is your area of expertise. You can take over the episode now.
Okay, so objects, when you go behind them, you don't disappear. People can still see you. Yep. I learned that in 1989. It's called object permanence.
Uh-huh.
What else? Food, if you want it, you got to scream.
You want it? You want it? Yeah. You got it. So anyway, 1989, Sega couldn't even wait 3 years before ditching the Master System and trying again to dethrone Nintendo. They tried a couple things that would shape the video game world forever. First of all, in 1988, they released your bread and butter, the Sega Genesis. Second of all, they hired a man named Tom Kalinske. He had previously been the CEO at Mattel. He apparently revived a bunch of franchises there, brought the world Masters of the Universe. But then Sega hired him on as CEO of Sega of America, and he took this many prisoners. This is for our live stream viewers. That's a zero.
No? Okay.
He took zero prisoners. You might be did you ever see those commercials that were like, Sega does what Nintendo don't?
Yes.
Yeah. They started doing something that no one had really ever done before. They went directly after Nintendo. Tom's strategy was to take all of Nintendo's weak points and exploit them. So in their very first commercial, you can go find compilations of these on YouTube. They sort of beat around the bush. They're like, it has twice the power, twice the challenge, and twice the fun. And this was, first of all, a reference to the NES being an 8-bit system and the Genesis being a 16-bit system. So they didn't call direct attention to it, but they're like, it's double. That means it's better. But by the second commercial, they were calling themselves the new generation of video games. And then by the third commercial, they were doing the Sega does what Nintendo, basically flipping the burden to Nintendo.
Sega is what Nintendo didn't, is the phrase, Nicholas.
Sorry. They had all of these. They had the Nintendo commercials. They had these, like, the world before Sega, and it was like these little beeps and boops, someone sitting in front of their TV like falling asleep, and then it was like after Sega, and it's like got Sonic running around the screen and like all these Street Fighters punching each other and all kinds of, like, you know, I don't think Street Fighter was on the Sega, but you know what I mean, they had like all this action. There's even, like, I don't know how they got away with this. There was one where they had, like, later on, they had a Super Nintendo next to the Genesis. And, I mean, they may as well just had the Genesis pooping all over the Super Nintendo.
But yeah, it's mean. It's aggressive.
It was very aggressive. As a child, were you familiar with these? Did it influence your purchase of the Genesis?
No, my dad just, like, brought it home. As far, I don't even remember that day. I don't know what my first game on it was, even. Probably Sonic. Play Sonic 1.
Yeah, I think it came with... There's a lot of bundles they did back then, but on the back end, they went after Nintendo's quality control as a direct response to Nintendo's seal of approval. Sega offered loosened licensing restrictions to offer game developers a lot more control. They went to these people and they said, hey, you know how it's not fun making games for Nintendo? Well, it's fun making games for us because you can basically do whatever the hell you want. And it worked. They got a huge library. Nintendo never really replied, but they released the Super Nintendo as, I guess, as a response for the Super Famicom in 1990, 2 years later? And even though it technically had superior hardware, there were some games that if too much stuff started appearing on the screen, the games would lag. And, of course, Sega jumped right on this, showing off the ability of Sonic to run lightning speed across the screen, and they called it blast processing. So you see all these blast processing ads, and they also cater to a more mature audience. Like Mortal Kombat had a code that you could activate blood on the Genesis, where it didn't on the Super Nintendo. There's no blood to be found. I think the second Mortal Kombat just had blood. I could be wrong about that.
It does. I had it.
Yeah,
it was just in options. You don't have to like enter anything secret or anything.
Yeah. So, further in the name of slapping Nintendo in the face, they released the Sega CD in 1991, which supported better graphics, better audio, full motion video, as where you get games like Night Trap, and it would exist with your, or it would work with your existing Genesis. You just plug it in, and then you put the CD in. And by 1994, Sega dominated 55% of the video game market. The Super Nintendo still outsold it, but just barely. It sold about 10 million more units than the Genesis. But the sheer volume of games and all these accessories made Sega a competitor in the market. And this is where things get very interesting, in my opinion. John, if I were to ask you, when is the first time Nintendo released a CD-based system, what would you say?
My brains are struggling. I'm firing up my own CD up in here. let me think real quick. I mean, I'm going to probably say Sega CD, right?
No, Nintendo, sorry.
Oh, Nintendo?
Yeah.
Is it GameCube?
Yeah. Well, so in Japan, it was they had a disc drive for the Nintendo 64, but in terms of worldwide CD, it wasn't until the GameCube in 2001 that they finally introduced CD-based games. But that doesn't mean they didn't try to compete with the CD drive that Sega was offering. They saw what they were doing. They saw that they had 55% of the market, and they did what any rational person would do. So they called up the world's premier CD producer at the time, Sony, who had put out the first CD player, the first commercial CD player, and they said, "Hey, can you help us make a CD attachment for the Super Nintendo?" And they said, "Sure." But eventually, Nintendo canceled the project. Sony was pissed about it. Sony had already started work on it. They had the hardware in development. So they took it and they made their own CD-based system. They said, "You know what? We can do this on our own." And in 1994, Sony released the PlayStation, a 32-bit system with 3D graphics.
Oh, my guy.
I know.
Wow.
Can't play move Twisted at that speed. I know. That's about it.
Oh, that's nice to play. I guess people grew up playing Solid Snake, but wasn't my... Or Metal Gear Solid.
Metal Gear Solid. It sold for $299 or $516 in today's money. And
was that the first 3D system, though?
Sega had the 32-bit drive, and I can't remember if that was before this. I think it was, but it was the first 3D system that people actually bought.
That's fair.
They took notes from Sega, and I sort of remember these. They had all these commercials where like Crash Bandicoot would be driving around, or he'd be out on the street and he'd say things like, "I'm coming for you, plumber boy," or "Starting to feel like your days are numbered? Well, you should," and all these edgy, dumb things like that.
And 90s were, man. It was like...
I'm not saying these aren't out there, but I tried finding any commercial where Nintendo would slap back at Sony or Sega, and I couldn't find one. So if they exist, I mean, I found them readily available on YouTube for Sega and Sony. So if they were out there for Nintendo, they were pretty rare. And
it's because there's a culture of respect, which, you know what, Nicholas?
Yeah.
This brings me to a direct point. This is the perfect segue, that Americans are not wearing masks, and we really need to get into this debate right now.
Yes, respect people around you, damn it. I bring all this up because I think it's interesting that Sony and Sega were able to paint Nintendo as this childish system, even though most of the games were on par with what was coming out on the PlayStation or the Genesis. Like, Sonic was on par with Mario, right? It's just that Mortal Kombat had blood and it didn't on the Super Nintendo. But this image endures up until the GameCube. It was one of the attacking points for the GameCube. And then finally with the Wii, they're just like, screw it, fine. Yeah, we are a child system. And Sega tried to remain relevant in this world of the PlayStation by releasing they tried to release the Sega Saturn a week before the PlayStation. This was the 3D system I was thinking of. First of all, those ads are creepy. If you look them up, you'll probably remember them. There's just like this bald lady with a Saturn ring around her head. And she's like, you're entering another world, the Saturn. It's very uncomfortable. But the system, like I said, it's supposed to launch September 2nd on Saturn Day is what they called it. It was a week before the PlayStation. And our hero, Tom Kalinske, made a bunch of mistakes that tanked the system. In May that year, the first ever E3 was being held. And Tom, trying to be the cool guy he is, said, just kidding, it's out today.
What?
In May, you know, 4 months early. So no one was prepared for this. Availability was scarce. A bunch of retailers were kind of scorned by this. KB Toys were so pissed off, they refused to sell the Saturn. It was also $400 or $670 in today's money, which is more expensive than a launch PS3. So Sega only sold 9 million units. Sony sold over 100 million PlayStations. That's about as much as the NES and the Super Nintendo sold combined in one system, yeah. Their very first system. This was nearly the end of Sega. They tried to return to the market in 1998 with the Dreamcast. That only sold 9 million units as well, and they just kind of threw
Dreamcast
it in the towel.
Was sick, though.
It was. I had one. The graphics were like way ahead of their time. Especially when you compare it to what was available at the time, the N64 and the... I mean, it's 98. The N64 came out in 96, which is... And that's how they tried to answer the PlayStation with the Nintendo 64. And while it had a lot of revolutionary games, it only sold 30 million units. Barely a third of what the PlayStation sold. And honestly, not a lot happened after this. Sony answered their own system in 2000 with the PlayStation 2. What was interesting about this, though, was it used DVDs, which were far superior to CDs, as everyone knows. But it was also very early on in the DVD game. This was a time where, for just a few extra bucks, you could get a game system and a DVD player. Nintendo came out with the GameCube a year later. Microsoft entered the fray with their Xbox that year as well, but they couldn't compete.
And boy, oh boy, was it convenient that at the same time these systems are coming out, so are DVD-Rs and ROMs online.
That's what killed the... Well, I think the Dreamcast was on CDs, but that's what killed it was piracy. The Xbox marketed itself as a mature gamer system, and the Nintendo was again cast as a child system, and the PlayStation 2 is just over here like, yeah, we have thousands of games and you guys don't, so that's why we sold so many. In the end, the GameCube only sold 20 million units, the Xbox sold 24 million units. And the PlayStation 2 sold 155 million units.
Yeah.
Which is
bonkers. I have PlayStation 2. I used to play SSX Tricky on it.
God, it's the best game is so ever. Good. I think about that game a lot, and I don't know why. I was thinking about it like 2 days ago.
It's just like an open-world snowboarding adventure.
Yeah, that game's so good. I was thinking about it because the song came up on TikTok, and I was like, God, SSX Tricky was such a good game. Anyway, it wasn't until the next generation of games, the seventh generation for those keeping track at home, that Microsoft finally hit their stride, mostly because Sony had such a clunky launch. I kind of tried to plant the seed about this earlier, but they tried to repeat their trick that worked so well with the PlayStation. They came out very early on in the DVD process, so they tried to do that with Blu-rays. So when the PlayStation 3 came out, it was one of the only Blu-ray players on the market. The problem was, it was $600. And Blu-ray players were expensive, but they were only like $200. So you weren't shelling out a couple extra bucks, you're shelling out four Benjamins just to get this thing that played a couple games. At the end of its life cycle, though, both consoles ended up selling the same, the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation. So the PS3...
up because it's like I don't think of the GameCube and the Xbox in the same era. Even I know that we're moving past that still,
I know,
but...
Well, this is where I think the industry starts to find a little bit of peace. So I'll go through these sales figures real fast. The PS3 sold 80 million. The Xbox 360 sold 84 million. So barely squeaked it out. But Nintendo did something new. They stopped competing with Sony and Microsoft and instead said, hey, how can we print money? And they came out with the Wii, which ended up selling 100 million units. They also came out with the DS, and Nintendo is back in the game. Except, in my opinion, I feel like this is a turning point. Even though it's super recent, it still feels like a turning point where, again, like they weren't competing with Sony or Microsoft anymore. They were on their own market. And I think they've even further solidified that with the Switch. Because when you talk about competing consoles in what's coming up, the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox X Series, which is the dumbest name ever, the Switch doesn't enter the conversation, though, because of course, like, you want a Switch, but that's not going to prevent you from getting either an Xbox or a PlayStation. The competition is between those two now.
Yeah, it's weird that the culture, they just kind of like stepped back and said, we're just totally doing our own thing.
Yeah, and it works. Some people, I say all this to say, some people still claim the console war is still going on today. I found these two very frustrating articles from Forbes. There was one from early on in February this year. Which one was first? I think it was, there is no console war because Xbox moved on and left PlayStation behind. That was like February 2nd. And then February 28th, also from Forbes, just a different writer, there's an article called, there's never really been a console war because PlayStation left Xbox behind from the start.
Yeah.
Yay, journalism. I wonder why you're dying. But
Xbox comes with a free subscription to Microsoft Word, though, I heard. So
fantastic. I mean
a demo. You can only write in papyrus. But
yeah.
It's still work.
Yeah. I just feel like in today's world, companies have moved away from directly attacking each other. They've definitely loosened up on their hatred for each other. Nintendo's working on their own thing. I mean, Nintendo's even worked with Microsoft. Everyone's doing cross-platform play now. It feels a lot less hostile than it used to, which I think is better for everyone. I mean, when you get to, we're at a point now where you can't really do a lot. You just have to improve frame rates and resolutions, and the hardware inside the new Xbox and the PlayStation 5 are basically the same. It's just, who are you a fanboy from? And I feel like who are you a fanboy from comes from Sega's marketing on the Genesis. That's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, they started this brawl.
It's just, it's nuts to me. But to close out our show, in case anyone is wondering where the sales came in for the 8th generation, the Wii U, remember that?
I have one. That was the last, my favorite game of all time was Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
And that's, I played it on the Wii U. You bought it for me.
I did. It sold 13 million units. Not good. The Xbox One sold 40 million units, and as of March, and I say this because not only was it what was on Wikipedia, but also because a lot has changed since March, the Switch had sold 56 million units. I imagine that number has skyrocketed in the last 3 months, but the PlayStation...
I've been able to buy one for months.
What's that?
They're sold out.
Exactly. Yeah. But the PlayStation 4, Sony did it again. They sold 106 million units so far. They're on their own league. I don't know.
Modern Warfare.
Which is weird because I wasn't a Sony fanboy. I still don't think I am. I have a PlayStation 4. I was an Xbox fan. I was a GameCube fan. I got a PlayStation 2 way late in its lifespan. I don't know. I had an Xbox 360 and I was adamant that it was better than the PlayStation 3. But then like a year later, I got a PlayStation 3 and never touched my Xbox again.
I can't name a single game on PlayStation 3. I don't think I've ever touched one.
Little Big Planet, Mod Nation Racers. There were some iToy games I liked. There was...
I used to play iToy on PlayStation 2, though. That's what I associate that with. Where you would use to scrub the screen.
Yeah, that was fun.
It was wishy, wishy, washy. Had that funny song.
I don't remember the songs, though. I never had the iToy. I had to play it at a friend's house. But, I mean, I'm trying to solidify my point that Sony has clearly ruled 3 out of 4 generations that they've competed in. And all of these companies have realized their system's going to sell no matter what. So just keep making good stuff and people are going to buy it. Just quit alienating people.
Well, now they have a new technique necklace, because let me tell you, every time that there's an update for their most popular game, Call of Duty Modern Warfare, you have to make room for like 800 gigs or something stupid ridiculous, to the point where now you need your own. You need 2 PS4s. You need one for Modern Warfare, one for the game you want to play, like hundreds.
Yeah.
It's literally, we've deleted, I think, 40 games off the system just to make room for one game.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Well, that's not going to get any better. They finally, this next generation, are getting into solid state drives, which is ridiculous. Those have been around for years. They were around before the PS4 and the X-Bone came out, and people...
Yeah, the X-Bone? Yeah.
They didn't want to introduce them, but... oh, no, that's all I have on video games. I think that was a wild enough ride, don't you?
I think so.
Should we take a quick break? And when we come back, I want to talk about our favorite video games of all time. How about that?
Sure. Where can people find us, Nicholas?
That's my job. What are you doing? People can find us at StrangerStillShow.com. You can also leave us a review on iTunes. That's the best way to share us. I don't know.
How about our name out there? If you leave a review, I'll sing it.
Really?
Really? Yeah. I know it's tough to believe that I have that capability, but I'll tell you what, Nicholas.
Yeah.
I got more than one vocal cord. You might call them vocal cords, and I'm going to use them to please your ears. All right. That's all I'm going to do.
Okay.
You're going to leave your fingers. You're going to take your phalanges, type them up on your little phone, your little computer phone, and put that in there. And I'm going to sing it real good. How do you feel about that, sucker?
I liked it up until you introduced phalanges.
Okay. Got aggressive, huh?
It got aggressive. Anyway, you can also find us at twitch.tv/thenickwood on Tuesdays at 9 Central. We are live streaming these. In fact, we're live streaming it right now. How crazy is that? John's camera froze, but he's back.
It said you can find us at twitch.tv. How crazy is that? It just kind of...
These are the kinds of things you're missing out on. Also, yep. If that's not enticing enough, we spent a half an hour before we started actually doing the episode writing an email to a data broker. So that's the kind of stuff that you're missing out on.
What? Reading emails to data brokers?
No, I think it's interesting. I want to do an episode on it, but that's the kind of stuff you miss. If you're not catching us live, follow us on there. We post it in the Facebook group and all that stuff. But John, what's your favorite video game of all time?
Zelda Breath of the Wild, probably right now, besides Earthbound.
Okay.
And now Modern Warfare is up there.
God,
you're not
such a basic B.
Yeah. It's so good. It's like saying that you like pizza.
Yeah, I do love
it's
pizza.
Really good. God, yeah,
pizza.
But what a lame answer though. You and every kindergartner that was ever asked that.
That's true.
That's Modern Warfare. It's pizza.
Oh, also, on our live stream, just taking a step back, the things you miss when you're not here is my daughter came down to say goodnight to me, and John talked to her about feeding our fish. It was very cute, but that's the kind of stuff you miss out on.
Yeah.
So, my favorite games, I have a few. First of all, Banjo-Kazooie.
Yeah.
That game is like 10 out of 10. I could be happy with that for the rest of my life. The other game I feel that way about? Psychonauts. Because they're basically the same game.
Yeah, you made me play Psychonauts too. I didn't beat it though.
That game is so good. It's it feels a lot like Banjo-Kazooie in that like you get a different power-up every once in a while. But it's also a lot more creative. It's just so good. If you haven't played Psychonauts, you need to do that. The third one that comes to mind is a wild card, but it's a game that I have bought, let me count, at least 6 times.
Can I guess?
At least.
Have we played it together? Is it Castle Crashers?
It is Castle Crashers.
Yeah. Which reminds me of one of my favorite games growing up, which is the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, like, there's one stage that feels very influenced by Turtles in Time, I think. But that game, grew up on Newgrounds, did a lot of stuff on Newgrounds. You could probably find my stuff there, like Lion Simulator. But the founder of Newgrounds, Tom Fulp, and one of the artists that I am a huge fan of, Dan Paladin, formed the Behemoth. So I've been a fan of them since forever, Alien Hominid and all that. But Castle Crashers, like, it was the first game that me and my brother Jake played a demo for it. We got to the boss fight and we were like, we have to go to Walmart, get Xbox Live points and buy this right now. That's what we did. So like I bought it then. I bought it for a friend to play with me. I bought it on PC. I think I bought it for someone else on PC, probably my brother. I bought it on the PS3. I bought it on the Switch. I can't remember if I've bought it on the PlayStation 4 yet. I don't think I have.
You got it on Steam so we can play.
Yeah. So that's one of those games that I've probably put hundreds of hours into it. I checked my Steam, but I played it on Xbox the most, and that's dead. So, yeah. Castle Crashers, man.
We should play that, like, as friends sometimes.
Yeah, let's do it, man. We could live stream.
Okay. Can I also, I gotta give a shout out as far as, like, actually growing up playing something.
Yeah.
Besides just regular Super Mario 64, which I used to play with my parents, because they were, like, blown away by the graphics and stuff, too. Yeah. And there was one level I couldn't beat. My mom was a good mom. She stayed up all night, and she beat the penguin at the...
The penguin race?
The peak. Yeah, penguin race level. And, that was a dead-on impression. That's the right pitch, too, yeah. As a musician.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
But Mario Party is like a family, like, anytime I'd have any family event, it would be Mario Party. Doesn't matter which. Like, we would just, as we grew up and they came out with new ones, because there's, like, 8.
Yeah.
And I think
there's 11 we would play now.
Those. There was a real, like, 6 through 10 were not great. This one is pretty good again.
Yeah, every time you come over, we play around, I feel like.
Well, yeah, which has been, like, what? Well, I'm not for Stranger Still, at least. Yeah, it's like rare lately.
Well, yeah, but it's such fun. Video games are good. Like, it's fun watching my wife get into Animal Crossing. It's fun watching my daughter get into Animal Crossing. My daughter asks me to play Mario Maker because she just likes watching me play Mario Maker. Here's a funny story.
That's awesome.
For you. I'm such an idiot.
Oh, good.
When Mario says, let's-a go, you know this? You know when he says, let's-a go?
Mm-hmm.
When me and my brother were kids, we thought it'd be funny because it sounds like he says, Mexico. So every time he says, let's-a go, we'd say, Mexico. Well, I was playing Mario Maker. My daughter was watching me, and he says, let's-a go. And I was like, Mexico. And I thought nothing of it. And then the next time I played it, she's like, I like it when he says Mexico. And I was like, oh, honey, your dad's just an idiot. He says, let's go. Just don't listen to me anymore.
I teach her geography. Wrong. Apparently.
Yeah, she does know a lot about geography. I taught her. She asked about Australia the other day, and I don't remember why. Oh, because we were watching Ben Folds, and he's stuck in Australia right now. And it was morning for him, and so I said, "Yeah, he's in Australia right now." And then we pull out the globe, figure out where it's at. It's an educational experience.
Dude, Ben Folds is helping young minds expand, fella.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, I think that'll do it for this week's episode. I'm still Nick.
I am still John.
And this is Stranger Still.